Good evening, friends, colleagues, distinguished guests. I will be your master of ceremonies tonight. My name is Ivan Marias. I'm the Dean of Engineering. And before we continue, I just would like to remind everybody that if you have a mobile device on you, please set it now on flight mode or on some mode that it doesn't disturb anybody, and certainly not a lecture. So let me begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land we are in, the Wurrumbidgee people of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respect to their elders past and present. Tonight we have the great pleasure of being able to invite Dr. Sharon Nunes, Vice President of Smarter Cities, Government, Industry, Strategy and Solutions from IBM, to address us. She does that on the occasion of 100th birthday for IBM and also the 150th birthday for engineering at University of Melbourne. So two big birthdays to celebrate this year. I must say that Sharon had a much more lovelier title before as Vice President of Big Green Innovations, a topic that has grown to become the topic she has now, being responsible for cities and the future. And she will talk today about her portfolio, Smarter Cities, IT, and the Future of Prosperity within that context. Sharon is a very distinguished executive within IBM and has played major national roles within the United States. In particular, she worked also in the National Academy of Engineers. And there's another connection with the school here, that she was one of the architects of the Engineer of 2020 report in the United States, a report that was very influential in defining what the educational model is actually underlying here, the Melbourne model at University of Melbourne. She's a role model for women in IT and engineering, and she has been rewarded with an IBM Mentoring Award in 2004 for her particular role in that area. She's also very active as a Society for Women in Engineers, and she's, in general, basically, more awards than I can actually spend the time, and you really need to listen to Sharon and not to me. So please let me invite and help me invite Sharon to the lectern to listen to her interesting talk.
Thank you, Dean. I think, you know, usually if people read my bio, it's pretty embarrassing, and, you know, my mother hears it and she says, "That's my daughter," and my husband hears it and says, "Who are they talking about?" So just as well that you didn't read it all. Thank you so much to the university for inviting me here as part of IBM's Centennial Lectures. I've had the privilege of talking to many organizations, many groups around the world about what we're doing in smarter cities over the last couple years. But more important now, I think over the last few weeks, we've really been driving this very actively in IBM because of our centennial anniversary about 2 weeks ago now. And I should mention before I pop into the slide presentation here that IBM launched its Smarter Cities program at the end, officially announced by the chairman, I should say, at the end of 2008. And there was tremendous debate inside IBM whether we should announce it at that time, because if you remember the time frame, in September 2008, Lehman Brothers in the U.S. collapsed, and it was the beginning of the financial crisis. So we're in the middle of this big new campaign in IBM and thinking, what are we doing? Because it's a tremendous investment in people's time and, of course, the marketing, all the energy that goes around it. But the chairman said, no, this actually is the right time to launch it, because the whole goal, and I hope I show you some of that here today, is to help cities think differently about how they can use information technology to focus on growth and their prosperity, hence my title. And he also has another saying that we've heard very often, those of us in IBM, that's very much around, you know, in times of crisis, there's also a tremendous opportunity for those who can take a leadership position. So I think many of us, I know some of my colleagues are here, many of us who are IBMers, very proud to be part of the thinking along those lines. So I'll talk about cities now, and I'm not one to stand behind a podium, so you'll have to bear with me while I wander and turn to look at the slides so I remember what I'm supposed to be telling you. But the whole notion around cities being really important to the whole global economy is pretty obvious when you look at this night picture of cities around the globe. And this is not, certainly not encompassing all of the cities. But the point here is they drive a tremendous amount of our GDP on a global basis. And what we have seen in the last 100-plus years is a tremendous change of the population in cities from 13% in the year 1900 to over 50% of the world's population today. So about, I think it was in 2007 where it crossed the population barrier where more people were living in cities than in urban areas. And that has continued to grow to the point where in about 2050, as many people who are on the entire planet today will be living in the cities of the world. And this is just a show of the growth rates here. It's about 100,000 people a day, or a city the size of New York, somewhere around 8 million people these days, I think. A city the size of New York being added to the planet just about every week. So tremendous change in the population structures. Almost every major city I talk with is expecting 20, 30, 40%. I think the numbers that I've seen for Melbourne is about a 20% growth in the next 10 plus years. And I guess, some people will ask, why are people moving into cities? It's typically for access to healthcare, access to education, access to jobs. And as we see this tremendous population shift, what we're also seeing is a huge amount of pressure on the existing infrastructure. So think about the infrastructure that exists in Melbourne today. When you add 20% more people, how are you going to sustain the transportation systems, the electricity systems, the water systems, the social systems, so that you can have a livable city, a city where people still want to be there because of the access to education and jobs, et cetera. And some of what we've seen in the last few years, and I think, only in China can we have a traffic jam of that magnitude, one that lasted 10 days. This is in the news all over the U.S. During the period of, I think it was about a year and a half ago. And every time we see these tremendous pressures on the infrastructure, think about the cost to cities. Right? They have a tremendous cost of resources and time in responding to those events. And that's money that could otherwise be spent in areas that could help the city to be growing. And for those of you who are involved in any of these domains related to water, food, or energy, you know that there's a tremendous interaction with all of those. I think a lot of people don't understand that the growth in population is not just a linear change in all of these areas, but water and food, for example, the water demand has increased more than twice the population over the last century. And as we continue to grow, adding 50% of people to the planet over the next 30 to 40 years, we'll see not just a linear increase in the water demands or the food demands, but people who are coming out of the bottom of the pyramid will want to have water for their dishes and for their washing, water that is now obtained by walking several kilometers to get water out of the ground and bring it back. They'll want to have water to their homes. They'll use more water. They'll change their diet, and their diet, as it goes from a grain-based diet into higher consuming higher water diet, which is typically more of the vegetables, legumes, and meat, will put tremendous demand on the food requirements, the water that's required for food, and the energy infrastructure as well. And city leaders are really focused on how do I deal with these problems and how do I continue to drive prosperity for my city? Because ultimately, if you have prosperity in the city, you'll get the organizations, the businesses coming there. They'll be offering the jobs. You'll have the tax base. You'll have people wanting to be there because of access to jobs. And it just becomes a wonderfully sustaining circle of events that allows you to grow into more and more prosperity. But the reality is the city leaders are dealing with that aging infrastructure that I mentioned earlier. They're dealing with tremendous pressures of decreasing budgets. And if you pick up any newspaper in any city around the globe, you'll see the challenges, or you'll read about the challenges that governments are facing. It doesn't matter if it's a city government, if it's a state government, or a national government. They're all under tremendous pressures. And the changing demographics, the people who are moving into the cities. In some areas of the globe, aging population and changing social structures to support that. And last but not least, the increasing threats that we're seeing from either man-made actions, sometimes terrorism activities, or natural disasters such as we've seen in Japan, in Christchurch, and other areas of the globe, the massive flooding that we've seen in the U.S. the last few months. So city leaders are really driven to think about how they can respond to this. And many of them are dealing with these decreased budgets by having massive layoffs, even in areas around the world where we've seen them having to lay off police and fire, formerly untouchable because those are kind of the foundations of a safe city. And what they're realizing is they can't just keep working harder. They can't just keep doing things the same way. They really need to think differently about how they're responding to some of these threats and how they can really rethink the use of information technology, new business processes, new ways of collaborating to drive change and ultimately to go back to that driving prosperity for the city. And so what we're helping them to do in many cases with our focus on information technology is helping them to integrate a lot of their city operations. And I'll go through several examples to give you a much clearer picture of how we're doing that, what we're doing, and what some of the results are. But when we talk about smarter cities in IBM, we will often talk about the integrated operations in a city. And most cities have a way of doing this already, but it's typically by picking up the phone. I happen to know someone in another organization or another department in my organization, so I'll pick up the phone. So there are interconnections, there are ways to integrate, and some of the more advanced cities are really integrating their operations, at least to some extent. But when a natural disaster happens, you find all the weak points in that system, and you see the breakdown in communications. You see the breakdown in information flow. And that's where IBM is really applying a lot of thinking and a lot of our software and systems engineering thinking to help them to better manage some of those. And ideally, if you take advantage of a system that allows you to integrate that information, you can bring information together, you bring data together, you can start to look at some of the patterns on city operations, what's happening around the world. You can start to get into some capabilities of predicting what might happen, and allowing that to, and enabling that to drive some collaboration and communication amongst these different organizations. And ultimately, you want to be able to rapidly respond to any events that, again, help to drive that prosperity and help to just reinforce the notion of safety and security in a world that's rapidly changing. And ideally, cities are working to incorporate not just the functions that I have outlined on the edge of the circle there, but integrating some of the human services and some of the focus around governance structures there. And the ones that are really forward-thinking here are also including external organizations. So you're not just putting a circle around the city functions, but what are you doing to integrate some of your businesses and some of the services like hospitals and non-government organizations, non-profit organizations that are really also providing services to your cities? And we do that, right, with some of the cities around the world because those organizations are a critical part of the city's prosperity. They are also helping to drive economic growth. They're employers. They're attracting some of the knowledge workers. Many city leaders around the globe now are trying to attract knowledge workers the same way that cities were trying to attract tourism, believe it or not, over the last few years, because they realize that knowledge workers are going to bring more revenue into the city, more growth. Knowledge workers are also going to attract more businesses. So again, back to, you know, how cities are thinking about being more prosperous, they really want to attract the right economic development activities in their city and ultimately contribute to growth beyond their own city functions, but enabling the businesses and healthcare systems around them to provide that consistency to their citizens. Over the last probably 2 to 2.5 years since IBM's been involved in this program, we have done about 2,000 projects around the globe. And what we have learned from that is thinking about the common patterns that have emerged as we've worked with public safety officials around the globe or water organizations around the globe, or as we've worked with electrical utility organizations, fire and police. We're starting to see common patterns in all of these cities, whether they're in Asia, whether they're in developed countries, whether they're in North America or South America or Europe. And what we've done is incorporate some of that information into a platform that really helps our clients then to implement some of these systems in a much easier basis. But it really helps us to work with them to provide the information so that they can anticipate potential problems and respond to them in a rapid manner. So I want to bring you through several examples to give you a much broader, or a much more concrete idea of some of the projects that we have undertaken. And Rio de Janeiro is a great example of a forward-thinking city leader who has understood that for his city to be successful in hosting the Summer Olympics and the World Cup coming up in 2014 and 2016, that he has to be able to respond to some of the natural disasters that have occurred, and he has to be able to anticipate whether any of those would be a potential threat while he hosts these world events. He also is very much concerned with the safety of his citizens, both before, during, and after these events, and has integrated a platform that allows him to connect weather events, potential severe weather events, with his environmental agency, with his public safety agency, to do planning and pre-preparation for hospitals if there is a potential event that might happen. And in particular, there were severe floods in Rio de Janeiro at the beginning of 2010 that actually triggered a lot of this discussion with him. So the environmental agency will connect to the hospitals, prepare them for potential onslaught of people coming there because of an emergency. They'll also contact some of the nonprofit agencies who might provide emergency shelter services. They'll contact the transportation systems in preparation for more public systems to evacuate some of the citizens in the city, and an overall coordination center that communicates with the citizens and helps to plan all of those interactions that are underway. So they're really intending to get advanced warning, looking at past and current patterns, integrate all that information, and provide very rapid information to the citizens and to all of the critical agencies that are going to help ensure the safety of the citizens. In Alameda County, California, we worked with an agency there providing social services to about 13% of the county's population. And one example that we heard had about 600 caseworkers in the city, and they were each handling several hundred cases, individual cases, for each person who was involved in the social services agency. And these people that they were serving were getting a number of social services from the city that might include education, workforce training, food stamps, health care, but none of that was integrated. None of it was shared information. And we essentially helped them to provide one view of the people they were serving, and it included minimizing duplication of services that were being provided in some cases, or not providing services that should have been provided, such as workforce training. And essentially, by working with them to integrate a system across the city, we're able to save them about $25 million in 1 year. And again, this was just integration of the information. I make it sound pretty trivial. It's not. But integration of information, access to information that can improve the benefits to the citizens in the city and save the city a tremendous amount of money. We're working in the smart grid, and I think it's probably a term that's common enough now where people understand what we mean by the smart grid, but it's an electricity grid that's basically run by an IP-based system that connects the central service, you know, the energy provider, to buildings and homes around the city in a pretty well-defined geographic area usually. And it has a central operation center, usually has a smart meter. In many cases, you can do time-of-day pricing for the actual energy usage. You can encourage people to use electricity in non-peak time, and you may want to incent them to do that by pricing mechanisms. So we have a few grid projects that have been underway. And one of the things that we like to look at from an IBM perspective is not just the technology implementation, which obviously is very important if you want a successful outcome, but the social aspects of that as well. Because a lot of what we're implementing with these IT systems is a technology that often either requires or drives a change in behavior. And in this example here in Dubuque, Iowa, it's a town in the Midwestern part of the U.S., the mayor was going from a previous metering system that was analog-based, and the meters were so scaled, so old, they had crust on the meters themselves, the internal mechanisms, that they were reading, you know, extremely low flows of water. So he knew right away that the water flow was not giving him an accurate reading, which meant the water company wasn't getting sufficient money for the water that they were delivering. As they moved to an IP-based system, they knew that they would get much more accurate readings, but then the implication to the end user, if you're someone in a home, you may see your water bill increase, and you wonder, boy, they put in these new meters, why did my bill increase? So he asked us, as we're implementing this pilot in Dubuque, to think about ways we could incent behavioral changes, and we worked with the social scientists to help create games and incentives for water conservation as they implemented the new meter system. And what you see here is, you know, some of the usage trends. You can look at your reduction. There's a way that you can go in there and you can look at households of the same size around the city, or you could look at the neighborhood. So you won't see individual homes, but you would see an average. So if my home is a four-person household, I could see how I compared to the average of other four-person households, or I could see how I compare to the average in my neighborhood. And they found, after a year of this pilot, about a 6.6 decrease in water consumption. Now, they were very pleased with that, but I think in Australia, just with some of the numbers I've heard on water consumption and the sense of urgency around the drought over the last decade or more or less, that number probably wouldn't be sufficient to get the results you need here. In the U.S., I think the average water consumption is something embarrassing like 500 to 600 liters a day. So I think that's probably a number that would be shocking to a lot of people here. Many areas in the western part of the U.S., are dealing with drought conditions, and it's very common for them to have significantly less water usage. But in the U.S., the water issues haven't quite hit home like they have here. But we are looking at ways that you can drive that change in behavior through some social mechanisms and engagement. Providing information, and back to that comment on Dubuque, providing information in a way that's consumable to the end user is an important part of driving change and encouraging people to collaborate. And in Peterborough, in England, we actually put together a very visual platform for the city planners. And these were multiple city organizations that had been operating in silos. Might have been the energy provider, the water provider, the city planners, the ones who are focused on carbon emissions because of the European Union directives, transportation organizations. And they're often in their own silos. And the first meeting that we had with them, they're all kind of sitting, looking at each other around the table. But when we started to present this information in a visual format to show them what the overall city looked like, so think of a Google map. This is basically a Google map with lots of information on it, looking at water consumption or energy consumption or carbon emissions or recycling efforts. They started to look at clusters around the city and the behavior of those clusters around the city and started talking to each other about, you know, how they could collaborate and maybe how they could continue to reinforce the type of behavior that they wanted, because they really want to put a tremendous amount of growth in the city. They're starting to move from an industrial-based sector into a green kind of innovation-like city and really trying to encourage the collaboration at the city council as they go through their planning for the next 20 years. in Ave Maria University in, and that's part of a smart grid because part of the, I think that's why I had it up there, because of the connection to the grid and, you know, being able to do some of the energy and water metering, although I didn't explicitly call it out on the slide. Here we actually worked with a business partner to implement an asset-based management system at Ave Maria University in Naples, Florida, to actually help them to save in some of their buildings costs and operating costs. Again, it's just knowing the state of your assets and the components in the building, being able to manage those and monitor them on a real-time basis is a tremendous building savings in building and operating costs. And in the St. Regis Hotel in, I believe this is, it's in China, I don't remember if it's in the north or the south, essentially looking at the building costs for a green building and the design of that based to, you know, what a normal hotel would be building. And the one of the parameters is the energy costs compared to their revenue. And this actually was designed at a much lower rate than a typical five-star hotel, which would be designed at about an 8% ratio. And the energy cost and savings ended up being about 40% compared to similar hotels. And this was done a few years ago and essentially trivial way of just turning on lights, automatic recognition of when people were there, some very simple things that initially happened and were able to drive down their energy costs by automation. In the public safety area, we've been working with several cities around the globe, and I think one list that you do not want to be on is the list of the top worst cities to live in. And that was the case in Richmond, Virginia, just a few years ago. And they were successively going higher on the list. Again, not something that you want to aspire to. And we helped them to look at different patterns of crime in the city and help them to integrate that information into a real-time response system with their police. And just one example that caught my eye when I, you know, was reading about the work that we were doing there, just highlighting to the police that on rainy evenings, after dark, of course, there was a much higher propensity for car break-ins in a certain region of the city. And knowing that type of pattern, you can then deploy your police and ensure that they're patrolling that area. And by looking at patterns like that, as an example, they were able to decrease crime 32% the first year, 40% the second year, and on a continual improvement basis. So I believe that in a matter of that two-year period, they were up somewhere around the 100 mark. So they were very pleased and obviously are continuing to use that to drive the response of their police and to try to improve the public safety in the city. And just a couple similar examples, again, using information, integrating information, providing it to the police and the responders. In New York City, the database there includes things like information on tattoos. So, you know, if you happen to, when the police are processing somebody, they may see a certain tattoo or they just may have a reference to that. They have a tattoo database that's integrated into information there. They have a database on nicknames. And so they have a lot of information that's now available to the police on the street in a wireless application that allows them to really quickly put disparate information together. And when there's a crime, they can access this information readily. Again, 27% reduction in crime using this information system. And in Madrid, it was essentially integrating their emergency response system, their medics, their ambulances, their fire and police, sharing that information, dispatching the right people to respond to the right type of emergency service, and improving the response time to incidents dramatically. Again, the reality, perception and reality of improving public safety is critical for a city that wants to continue to grow. Moving into transportation, some of the work that we've done around the world is actually focused on integrating fare cards, and this in Singapore, where they have one fare card that will allow you to move to any of the transportation systems around the city, around the island. And they also have it integrated to the level where if you're in a train and the train is running late, they can hold some buses to allow you to catch the bus and not have to wait for the next one. And if you know anything about Singapore, they're very structured and, you know, very much information driven. This is a terrific example of how they've used this integration of technology to provide a better transportation service to their citizens and to the visitors on the island. If you've ever traveled there, it's just an incredible transportation system. And more to, you know, back to the financial impact for them, it meant recovering about 80% of their lost revenue and really improving the financial operations as well. The Queensland's Motorway is a terrific example. I was with one of the directors earlier this week in Brisbane, and essentially this is an automated tolling system that allows for smoother traffic flow, and there's a lot of information technology that goes into it, from the prospect of billing, automatic recognition of the car or the license plate, ensuring that the billing goes to the right, you know, to the right person at the right time. You have to deal with rental cars and situations like that. But the important thing here is this 80% reduction in accidents, reduction in commute time, and, of course, the fact that they can claim no fatal accidents in the last year. It's actually more than that now. It's about a year and a half. And these are real results that are maybe hard to translate into a financial benefit for the city, but tremendous improvement, again, in allowing people on that road to get to where they're appointments, whatever appointments they're going to, on a much faster basis. And I know that there was a study done, I believe it was out of Harvard, about a year and a half ago, that indicated for a 10% improvement in transportation, so meaning that you spend 10% less time on the road, there was a tangible improvement in the GDP to the factor of about 1%. So again, having a very tangible result, because now people are getting to where they need to be much sooner. And I think the number in the U.S. for wasted time on the road averages about 5 days for every person in the U.S. So that means that I waste, on average, if I'm one of the average U.S. citizens, I waste 5 days a year sitting in traffic on the roads. So, and I used to do that, believe me, in a long commute into New York City. Not anymore. But that is just an average of, you know, the wasted time and the financial impact related to that. In Washington, D.C., I'm going to talk a little bit about, I think I've got a couple examples of what we're doing in water. In Washington, D.C., we're actually working with them to improve response to events in their water system. So typically, emergency events that would happen, their maintenance crews go out and respond to all the emergencies, but they don't respond to the non-emergencies. And typically, that's a very common pattern. If you have a problem in any systems, you respond to the emergency first, you fix it. There's probably another emergency waiting right after that. And we've helped them to cluster and optimize their work crews to respond in a certain fixed area. We've taken an area, we've helped them to optimize and look at both emergency and non-emergency repairs. It's enabled them to better schedule their crews. They've increased the work orders for the crews by 25%, and they've been able to decrease fuel by 10%. And in another area, which is the picture on the slide here, we've actually helped them to look at some of their assets in the system. So they look at assets like fire hydrants, valves, pumps, pipes. You know, people are also part of their assets, all of their work crews, for example. But in this case, they were having significant failures in some of their fire hydrants. So when they started to look at all this information, they found that over this period of time, the same, you know, the crews were going to the same fire hydrant multiple times. So within about a six-month period, I don't know if it's on there or not, but it was over about a six-month period, two or three times they had to go and fix a leak in one of the hydrants. And, of course, they were going to just replace all those hydrants, so they had a preferred type of manufacturer that they wanted to replace those with. When we looked at the data with them and did some of the analysis around these patterns, they found that it was a certain manufacturer that had leaks. It was the same hydrant in all of those situations. And it happened typically below about 40 degrees F, so what's that, about 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, I think, if I get my numbers right. And what happened is they started to have a problem with the contraction of the O-ring when the temperature got cold enough. So they fed that information back to the manufacturer, who, of course, fixed it. But it prevented them from actually buying more of those hydrants until that problem got fixed, because they would have really just, you know, added more problems to their own maintenance. system. So with the improvement in maintenance, of course, they now have higher customer satisfaction. The perception and the reality for their customers is that they're responding to these incidents much faster and that there's a lot better service and there are fewer breaks and fewer issues in the system. So again, use of information here that's really helping them to improve their operations, operational efficiency. In Corpus Christi, Texas, again, one of the water systems there where they're looking at some of the data around their maintenance and response, again, related to their asset management system, they were getting complaints from about, they didn't actually know it at the time, but it was the same cluster of residents that was calling them with a problem. And what they found, of course, was it was about 1%, and a number of the, about a third of their effort was being spent on this very small population. Once they started to see that pattern in the data, they looked at what the root cause of the problem was, fixed it, and then were able to actually go back to looking at what else in their system needed to be fixed so that they could spend most of their time on improving a larger percent of service for the bigger part of the population. In Sun World Farms, an agricultural program that we're doing in, I believe this is in California, I'm not sure if it says or not, but a lot of citrus and table fruits. So they're farming about 12,000 acres, and they're looking at IBM Cognos is an application that's very visual analysis, typically used for financial analysis, but it's a very visual platform that allows you to put data in and see some of the results in a GIS basis as well. And they started to look at, initially what the financial focus was there because they wanted to improve things like their labor productivity, wanted to improve the crop yield. And what they found by identifying some of the crops, by looking at types of new types of irrigation they were experimenting with, they found that some of the crops responded better, were able to implement this system. Again, they were driven by the financial analysis, but one of the results that they were actually able to save about 8% of their water use. And again, in California, this is a very critical area where they've been involved in drought for several years as well. And another area, energy-water nexus. If you know anything about the water industry, there are about, most of the water utilities tell us they spend about 40 to 50% of their operational cost on energy. And as you're moving water from one reservoir to another, in many cases where you're a bulk water supplier, a wholesaler, they're called sometimes, you're actually spending tremendous energy, unless it's all gravity-fed, in moving water to ensure that you've got right balance in your reservoirs to supply the distribution, multiple distribution points. And we help them by looking at different optimization patterns and trying to match their delivery of water to some of the energy usages. So back to, trying to optimize on a smart grid perspective, using energy either at a peak load capacity or a low load capacity where it could be very financially driven. In the water industry, just like in a lot of businesses, they buy their energy typically on a very large block, often 30 days ahead of time. If they misjudge that, they have to pay a tremendous differential if they have to buy energy on the spot. So one client in the United States told us they pay a factor of 100 difference in the same amount of energy if they buy it, 30 days in advance, or if they buy it 15 minutes in advance. So you really pay for that inaccurate estimate if you don't plan sufficiently for your energy costs. So part of the incentive here for DTE was to ensure that they could minimize that gap. They really wanted to ensure that they didn't have to go out and buy energy on the spot. So helping them to optimize around the lower cost energy really helped them to, improve their cost, saving about $8 million a year on this optimization. A couple areas that I think maybe a little bit different that people don't think IBM as delivering, but we're very much involved, based on a comment on our 100-year history, we helped to develop the barcode, we helped to develop the ATM machine. So just a lot of background in information technology and systems like that. We've been involved with a project in Venice, Italy, with the new 2D barcodes, where if you're a visitor to Venice, and I guess the best example is some of the cruise ships that might dump that's probably not a good word, that might leave several hundred people in the lagoon, you know, for a day's visit. And all of a sudden, the places are just inundated with people typically following the same pattern through the city, because you've probably all read the same guidebooks and you know that you go first to this location and second to this location. Using these 2D barcodes, you can walk up to a point, you know, check your camera, tell you a little bit about, you know, welcome to Venice, Sharon, and we recommend that you take this route through the city, and it'll tell you a little bit about where you're standing, what the sites are in that area. You know, please go to the next point, give you directions. Then you check that, you know, second location, and it'll tell you the same thing, give you information on the location, you know, a lot of the, you know, do some dynamic routing, recommend the third spot that you go to. So by the time you get 30 or 40 people from often the same cruise ship going to visit these locations, you can start to do a dynamic pattern distribution of all of the visitors. So they're not all going from point A to point B to point C. They're going from point A to point D to point F to point C, and really doing some smart scheduling so that you can actually spread out the traffic and everyone's much happier because you're not all clumped in the same location at the same time with minimal access. So just an interactive session there. In a project that we've been doing in some kind of, you know, iPhone apps and trying to engage people, citizen science, we call it, a citizen-based research, an iPhone app called Creek Watch that's actually available on the web. You can go in and download this onto your iPhone, go to your local creek, reservoir, streams, take a picture, and make some comments about the actual viability of that stream. Does it have a high flow, a low flow? Does it have debris in it? Is there contamination of one sort or another? And we're working with the California Water Board, I think is California Water Board, in Northern California to understand how to incorporate that information as supplemental information that can help them to, you know, essentially give them additional data points on the health of their water system. So if I'm a utility provider, I think I want to ensure that, you know, there's a way for me to validate that information, validate it. Maybe I use it to look at trending of things. If I have enough people saying that there's low water flow or there's significant debris, I can take that information and take certain action on it. I'm not sure I want people going out and taking temperature measurements or oxygen content of the water, but you know, this is an interesting application that really engages citizens in being more proactive about environmental issues. And that's one area where we think that there's an opportunity to use technology to really help to drive some, you know, awareness, education, engagement. And you can start to think about some of the crowdsourcing examples related to that as well. We developed a game for, I think it was high school and college students to use to really help them to understand city operations as we launched our Smart Cities program a couple years ago. And you can go in and pretend that you're a banking, you're your finance guy or gal, that you're leading a water utility, that you're leading an energy utility, and play this game to understand some of the changing parameters of operations in a city. So one of the scenarios I might get if I walk in and want to play the role of a water leader is the population is doubling in the next 5 years, your water systems are decreasing because of a drought, and how are you going to respond to that? So my score or my rating in the game will depend on how economically viable my city will still be. So there's a financial component there, because of course it's now going to impact businesses in the city. And it also depends on some score of citizen happiness. So if the citizens aren't happy because I'm putting significant pressures on them to reduce the water supplies, that will be part of my overall game score. So we've been using this now in cities in schools, and just using it kind of to raise the awareness level of some of the challenges that cities are facing and to make them more aware of some of the environmental issues as well. So we've done all these projects for a number of years, and hopefully that last kind of run-through of several examples gives you just an idea of how we're trying to integrate information, provide information to city leaders to help them to make decisions and improve operations. Ultimately, you know, what we have found is pretty consistent around the globe, you know, with city leaders in just about every geography we've worked with. What is driving them is this economic viability, prosperity. Almost every one of them says, I need to provide more jobs. I need to ensure that I have a safe place for my citizens to live. How can what we're implementing here from an IT platform get me on that road to prosperity? Economic growth is the foundation of just about everything. And a number of them are really looking at, you know, I've got an incredible number of pressures around me for decreasing budgets, this aging infrastructure. You know, how are we going to implement some of these systems? I know I can save the money, but what are some of the new business models that we can think about? What are some of the new ways we can think about implementing these systems that ultimately will drive better results, you know, for my city operations or for my city prosperity? And very often, one of the issues around how can I simplify the complexity of running my city? It's a very complex, interrelated, interdependent organization. And traditionally, a lot of those organizations are run in silos. They have different financial models for all of them. And the city mayor is really trying to balance all of those and to simplify, really bring those people together and simplify the operations, if at all possible. So they really want to drive simplification around the complexity that is natural there. They're all looking for a very rapid return on investment. So that is really essential for everything that they're doing. You know, they really need to show if they're implementing some of these systems that, just like some of the case studies I pointed out to you, that there is tangible financial benefit because they are being scrutinized by their citizens, you know, their stakeholders, the businesses, the city councils, all the different organizations are questioning the spending that's being done in the city, especially because it means money that's being spent on something that is not necessarily, you know, that is typically competing with jobs in many areas of the city. So these are questions that we've been facing over the last year. But overall, what we've been able to show to most of them is these tangible benefits and this value for integrating IT, better collaboration, and using information to really drive some insight. And certainly what we have seen because of the challenges in the governments around the world, the changing leaders, at least in the U.S., it's mostly on a four-year time frame, but very short attention span. If, you know, something critical happens tomorrow, their attention has gone from what's going on here today, and they may be off onto another project. So you really need to have strong, innovative leadership to carry out some of these transformations. You know, a lot of these changes don't happen overnight. Some of these projects were 1 or 2 years in duration, and you want to have a leader who is confident that that change will actually benefit what's going on in the city. Education and community engagement is absolutely critical. We need a leader who knows how to communicate and knows how to engage the citizens also. I think in Washington, D.C., the example that I gave you, the leader of that organization, the Washington, D.C. Water System, was able to pass a double-digit rate hike because he was showing that his investment in technology was really providing better services to his constituents. But he did that through extensive community engagement, educating his consumers on what he was doing, what the benefit was, how it was going to improve their lives, provide them more consistent water distribution, provide them higher quality water. And things like that are very critical because we also had an example in California about a year ago with Pacific Gas and Electric, and you can Google this on the web to find some of the case studies on it. But they implemented a smart meter program without doing a lot of communication and education. And they deployed it to several thousand of their constituents and had people call them up, say, come and get the meter. You know, take it back. It's charging me more. My electricity bill went up per some of the comments that I had made on Dubuque, Iowa. This is why the mayor there was very proactive at trying to educate his own constituents. What happened in the Pacific Gas and Electric example, a lot of the meters were taken out, and an independent task force was put together to try and understand what went wrong, because this was supposed to be a terrific pilot for demonstrating the value of a smart grid technology. And the nutshell, I think the report was issued just about a year ago now, the nutshell of it was that they failed to communicate and educate to their constituents what the value would be. They failed to say, the old meters that you have were extremely inaccurate. They failed to think about maybe the policy of an incremental pricing increase. So a lot of lessons learned from that experience for smart grid implementers around the globe, not just for electricity, but also for water. And, ultimately, technology is just an enabler. It's something that should be in the background. It's not the answer by itself. A lot of these things that are going on in cities, the transformation of operations, the dependency on citizens and their response is also very critical. So the more the city leaders educate and communicate to the citizens and understand what some of the social reactions might be, then the more successful some of these pilot projects have been. And of course, as cities start to do more and more, making their cities smart, there is an impact, to all of us who live in cities. And we want to at least understand what some of the options are. We want to understand what the impact on our own lives is going to be. So technology is an enabler, but it is certainly not the only thing that is going to drive the success of these pilot projects. So we in IBM are working with universities, University of Melbourne, other universities, to really understand some of these social implications and social interactions. How do you do this so that you drive the results that will really go back to benefiting the city, back to my earlier slide, drive prosperity in the city? Because ultimately, that's what it comes down to all of these city leaders. So, thank you.
Sharon has kindly agreed to take some questions. And just before you start asking questions, I'd just like to let you know that tonight the lecture is being recorded and your questions will also be recorded.
In case you don't want to ask any.
We have a question here in the front.
Thank you for an excellent exposition of how integrated IT can do things if the politics let it.
Yes.
I'd like to raise my question from the point of view of the expert consumer. The average level of education in the community has leapt ahead. In any small area, you can now get more competence in specialist areas than governments or consultants can marshal if you were to do it. One of the tools to engage this is data repositories, which were originally done to try to help organizations talk to themselves. Mm-hmm. It would be nice to hear your comments about, one, data repositories, and two, how the consumers are allowed to drive the system. If I may prompt you, for example, in smart grids, to be able, as a consumer, to monitor in real time what the retail plans are of the different suppliers and switch, rather than do the top-down approach. I just wanted to follow up your last points.
Ideally with the smart grid, to answer the second question first, because by the time I finish, I'll probably forget the first question, but the smart grid actually would enable that. I think it's really a policy. Right? We're still in very regulatory-driven environments with energy and water, and then you get into all the political issues that you reference. But technically, it could be done. Right? Even right now, I can go in and I can switch. I just don't have information at my fingertips, and it takes a little bit of time to fill out the paperwork and send it in and switch. So ideally, that could be a driver, again, for efficiency, customer service, because that's how the utilities will differentiate themselves, whether it's water or electricity. Now, it's a little harder to switch from a water utility because of the physical infrastructure, but I could see that being a future capability when the smart grid is actually fully implemented. And the first question was around data repositories?
Assembly of data that you do to achieve what you're describing, mm-hmm. But making it a form that's accessible to the community.
Yep. So we've had a number of discussions related to that, mostly with city leaders. And what in Peterborough, for example, they want to make most of that data, not all of it, they want to make it accessible to the public. So we're actually in discussions now with what is appropriate data, what's consumable data, and it depends on which area of the world you're in. How do you present the data so people actually understand it? And there is still a concern with some data, people probably don't need to know everything about the data that's in the, that's operating the system. But how much do you abstract and what do you present to them? So I'd say stay tuned to at least Peterborough, because over the next probably 6 months or so, we're hoping that we'll be able to answer that question, get information on the web, and actually determine, how people use that data, how do they interact with it, and how do some of their thoughts influence what's being done in the city. Is there another question
here? Question here at the 12th row.
Thank you very much for an excellent presentation of what these projects are doing to improve the life in the cities. However, there seems to be a basic assumption that we are doomed to greater and greater cities. In Australia, we have just launched the beginning of an NBN, National Broadband Network, and some of the advantages sold to us for that is that it will allow people everywhere to enjoy the same sort of life. So, what are your thoughts on using IT and communication to try and negate this accretion tendency which will force us all into cities?
That's a really provocative question. It's interesting because I think if you look at the demographics, all the projections for what's happening in cities, that's kind of a business as usual, right? This is the trends we've seen and we extrapolated, and therefore, in this period of time, we're going to see more and more people. And that has been the trend over the last 100 plus years. But I think, you think about kind of the black swan events, and if you think about a national broadband network, it can be a game changer. It actually could encourage people. Not everybody likes to live in cities, right? I don't live in a city by choice. I moved about a year ago to a very rural area. We don't yet have broadband network there, but one is being built. So I think I'll have my own experiment over the next year as well. But it can be a game changer. And I think that, with access to information, if it's stable, if it's readily available, could actually encourage people to stay where they are if you can get access to remote jobs. Now, again, not for everybody, but it could give you access to education, right? You can have the virtual health care in many cases as long as it's not a physical emergency. So it can provide you a lot of what a city might traditionally offer. And truthfully, if cities can't get a handle on managing this infrastructure and all of the pressures that are going to happen over the next couple decades, that may also be a catalyst for helping people to decide that they don't want to be in cities. If we end up with more issues like the 10-day traffic jam in China, with everybody trying to get to the same place, if that starts to happen in cities and you start to see a decrease in individual productivity, or you start to see issues with water quality or electricity reliability, you'll start to see people moving, into places where they feel safer, where they have access to that amenity, whichever one it is. And again, if you've got access to the internet reliably and can access the information, education, jobs, healthcare, it could actually change that whole trend. So very, very provocative. Maybe that's something that we can look at as the resiliency discussion that we've started in research, Glenn. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, last question.
Thank you for your presentation, Sharon. Peter Horman, I work for Telstra and am a champion for energy efficiency inside the company. I think it's Peter Drucker that said you can't manage what you can't measure, which is largely what your presentation's all about. It's about the data. And you've shown that sort of, at least after the fact, it's easy to show the return on investment, but before the fact, the challenge seems to be how do you get started when you're asking management to invest in a hypothetical outcome? It's like investing in quality. You've sort of hypothetically got, some improvements to make there and some resulting savings, but how do you get, how would you approach my CEO, David Thodey, and sell him an idea to invest in collecting this data so we can make savings?
Well, it's been much easier for us after we got these first, the results of some of these initial projects, because having tangible data, you know, what I would say for your case is, can you find similar organizations that have implemented something and there's tangible cost savings? To me, nothing speaks better than just having tangible cost savings. I mean, because it's not just cities that are dealing with the financial pressures these days, right? Every organization around the globe, there's still tremendous uncertainty in, you know, where the markets are going to go and how fast the economy will recover. So, you know, businesses are being very conservative, more so than they were 10 years ago. Cities are, you know, under tremendous pressures, as I highlighted. But having those concrete results to refer to and having something you can point to say, if you do A, the expected outcome is probably B, you know, essentially it's putting together a business case, or not a full business case, but a business proposal that says, you know, here's what we expect for the return on investment. And a lot depends on, again, I hate to say, a lot depends on the leadership and whether they really believe that investing will help to drive a transformation. And, you know, what's the benefit that they get? Sometimes it's not always just financial. You know, sometimes it's the perception and the marketing that you can get out of it, you know, if you're successful, because there's a tremendous amount of kind of client pressure now. You know, customers really want to know that whoever they're doing business with, you know, is investing in green, is conserving water, is minimizing carbon emissions. So there's a tremendous kind of marketing and PR value as well. That's the hard one to quantify. But I've read reports over the last few years about how the growth of these companies, you know, you can get it in a number of the sustainability websites, growth of those companies has typically been on a faster track than those who aren't perceived to be sustainable. So a lot of it's about getting some of the data to support what you want to do.
Well, let's thank Sharon for giving us a fantastic insight in what IT can do.